Hey guys, what's up? This is Chad Haig here in southern India. I'd like to continue the series of videos on the philosophy of Julius Evola by finishing part one today in this second out of four videos in the series. Today we'll be examining chapters 11 through 21. I want to start by thanking everybody who's participated. It's been a very interesting series of videos to do. I'm really looking forward to the rest, but I'd mention that if you enjoy this video and other discussions of controversial thinkers on my channel, you might be interested in my new book, The Hermeneutics of Ecological Limitation: Eco-Philosophy Beyond Environmentalism. This 250-page book will be released next week and for a limited time only will be available for under $10 on paperback and just $4 on Kindle. I will discuss eco-philosophy through thinkers like Julius Evola, Varg Vikernes, Ted Kaczynski, John Zerzan, John Michael Greer, as well as mainstream environmentalists like David Klass, Greta Thunberg, Pope Francis, and Anna Kasparian. And unexpectedly, this will be through returning to hermeneutics and language philosophy. Seeing how thinkers like Slavoj Žižek and Gadamer have argued that ecology and language are not the same thing, and certainly hermeneutics would not be the path to really grasp ecology rather than get lost in the stereotypes of environmentalism. That's precisely what I challenge in this book, and I had a lot of fun writing it. I look forward to continuing the discussion on topics which will never be given accurate representation within the academic marketplace of ideas. So let's go ahead and also mention the following disclaimer about this series on Evola. This video on Revolt Against the Modern World is for educational purposes only. The purpose of this video is not to promote Evola's theories as true, nor is it to refute them as false. The decision whether to believe them is solely up to the viewer. I acknowledge that Evola is a very controversial figure, but I don't support banning or censoring his works for that reason alone. So let's go ahead and get back to the text. In chapter 11 on hierarchical relationship between royalty and priesthood, you find that the king's primacy over the priesthood was something which was understood in the world of tradition to be symbolically akin to the sun's primacy over the moon and man's primacy over the woman. This is evident in the proper interpretation of the rite of consecration. If you have, say, the Pope crowning Charlemagne emperor, you have the risk maybe of misunderstanding what's going on there if you don't keep in mind that the traditional view would hold that the king is not really receiving this power from the priest. Rather, the king is assuming it. The priest does not therefore possess this power, but rather has custody over it. Although the king and the priest both have legitimate relations to divinity, they're fundamentally different. The priest, for example, is merely the interpreter of the divine, but the sacred king was understood to belong to the same stock as the gods. Therefore, although the Pope was originally subordinate to the emperor, first it was the emperor of Rome, then it was the emperor of Constantinople, and by the way, that only changed because in the Dark Ages there was somebody in Rome who forged a document supposedly from hundreds of years earlier, which relieved the Pope of having that relation to the emperor of the Byzantine Empire. But that was actually something of a later perversion, which set the Pope on the pathway to try to have the same ideal as the Lord of the Center, which actually belonged to the king. That did not belong to the priest. And this was a perversion of tradition, which led to the secularization of the state, the destruction of traditional hierarchical forms, and ended with the formless masses of democracy, which are sweeping away even the materialistic basis of power. The great irony is that the origin of this actually lay with the Pope himself. Therefore, in chapter 12, you find that the loss of the spiritual foundation that's always the true explanation for the principle of ruling falling into decadence. If you look at a counterexample for how that didn't happen, you can consider how the Holy Roman Empire, as an empire, was qualitatively different from the lower kingdoms which it encompassed. It was not just the case that the empire was a bigger kingdom, because the empire had a supernatural origin and a universal nature. The unity, in turn, of those kingdoms was not merely material, not merely military, not merely political. It could only be spiritual. A non-sacred empire is no empire at all. It's only a cancer. This is, of course, to be contrasted with the modern state. In our era, the political forms have devolved from something like a coherent organism in the world of tradition to a mere mechanism. Even if there is a temporary illusion of absolute power, it'll always be short-lived within this arrangement, as the indeterminate democratic masses will rise to take over the throne that had been desecrated. It is one of the supreme ironies of history, as I just mentioned, that it was actually none other than the Pope himself who created the condition for the secularized state of modernity. By the 13th century, for example, the Pope decided that anointing of the king had lost its sacred character. It would no longer be treated like the ritual of ordaining priests. Okay, but this unwittingly paved the way for a similar skepticism towards even the sacred character of ordaining priests. Religion, in turn, survived, but only in an increasingly privatized, abstract, and secondary form. Therefore, in chapter 13, you find that it was not only the king, but even the traditional nobility who had to be understood through this spiritual element. While the feudal aristocracy, of course, was connected to a land, the knightly aristocracy was super-territorial. It was not tied to any specific homeland, but rather to the universalizing empire itself. Knighthood was not necessarily hereditary, in that one could become a knight through certain heroic deeds. Significant acts on this pathway included fasting, symbolic purification in the bath, staying awake all night in prayer, wearing the white robe, etc. And the symbolism of horse was also quite significant, because the fear of being ritually demoted from the knight's rank, should he be unsaddled, was something with a deep meaning in this context. It is even said in the Indo-Aryan tradition that the Kali Yuga, or the Dark Age, will come to an end when the force embodied in a white horse returns to destroy the evil warriors who had been detached from the sacred. At any rate, something goes wrong if the notion of nobility loses its spiritual foundation and devolves into the status of being merely political. Contrary to expectation, the last image of the traditional world was in the Middle Ages, but precisely through a deviation away from Christianity back to the pagan ideal of a holy war as the ascetic path towards immortalization. This is what you really have in the Crusades, is the war to defend Christianity as something of a deviation to the pre-Christian world of tradition. Therefore, if you look at chapter 14 and the doctrine of the castes, despite its controversial character today, Evola claims that the caste system of tradition should be interpreted as another example of the victory of order over chaos. Properly interpreted, it embodies the metaphysical ideas of stability and, contrary to expectation, even justice. Far from being an artificial, unjust arrangement which could only be maintained through coercion, which is the stereotype today, Evola claims that conformity to caste was understood to be a duty. In fact, it was one's first and main one. In fact, there was no need to force people to submit to what was accepted by everyone as obvious. Far from being a mere device of the human will, this hierarchy was accepted as a law of nature. Somebody today would surely object that it would be just unfair for somebody to be trapped within a caste simply because they were born into it as a matter of accident. But this is a modern materialistic worldview which was actually unknown in the world of tradition, because everything visible was seen as a mere effect of causes of a higher order in the world of tradition. Birth was not seen as a result of mere naturalistic happenstance. It was understood that one was born into a given caste because one possessed a given spirit. Likewise, against the modern cult of personal accomplishment, achievements in the world of tradition were seen as nothing if they did not actualize some pre-existent will. In modernity, of course, we have reduced the broader world of causes down to the single category of physical heredity. That's all we have left. But this paved the way for qualitative destruction and relativist leveling out of all distinctions. As Linkola would say as well, democracy really just means that we're all the same. This and this alone is the true meaning behind any praising of having overcome caste. Modernity, by the way, has not given us the perfected social form. It's rather just given us chaos, says Evola. The decasted masses have actually been condemned to disharmony and perpetual social tension as a result. Rising up to one's caste's duty in the traditional world was literally understood ritualistically. It was the path of the earthly way. It was to be understood in this contrast of the path of the earthly way, which was utilitarianism, greed, etc., versus the path of the heavenly way. In fact, activity was precisely evaluated by its level of detachment from matter, greed, pathological motivation, etc., since these were necessary conditions for it to become a self-sufficient act. In other words, it was precisely the level of detachment from the naturalistic concerns of utilitarianism that made it into a self-sufficient act. Therefore, nobody actually felt ashamed, even of belonging to a low caste, because measuring success with merely material criterion was ruled out. One could realize one's spiritual nature at any rate. Decadence, on the other hand, is simply men abandoned to themselves, and that is not liberation, he says. Therefore, in chapter 15, talking about the arts, you find that any question of understanding the arts on a merely aesthetic grounds is itself a sign of decadence. If you look at prehistoric cave paintings, for example, they evidence that naturalistic elements were inseparable from magical intentions. Poetic verse, similarly, was understood to be incantation and divine inspiration. It wasn't just self-expression. The myth of Prometheus is similarly the symbol of a non-human origin of the arts, which was taken quite seriously. The Christian interpretation of the story of Adam eating from the tree and then basically being condemned as a result is not the only version of that myth. You also have the myth of Hercules, Jason, and Siegfried, who basically do the same thing, but thrive rather than suffer damnation as a result. Therefore, although the modern world condemns these archaic views of work, it's ironic that the slavery rampant today is actually far worse even than the literal cases of slavery which occurred within the world of tradition. If you look at the Stalinist work camps, by the way, they embody a type of collectivization which, while claiming to be based in secularized materialism alone, is actually designated by Evil as being outright satanic. Therefore, in chapter 16 on asceticism, you find that the caste system actually provides the context to understand what asceticism actually meant in the world of tradition. The ascetic was the one who was above caste, insofar as he was free from form and had renounced human individuality as illusory. The ascetic therefore realized transcendence not through respecting hierarchy, but by direct action. It's necessary to mention that there is something of a distinction between the traditional and the Christian views on asceticism. Whereas the Christian ascetic merely represses desire and seeks to flee from temptation, the traditional ascetic had an attitude more of distaste for the objects of the world. It's similarly hard for the Westerner to grasp the concept of nirvana, which can only appear maybe as the negativity of nothingness. But you have to understand that the Buddhist was he who was above both men and the gods. Therefore, in chapter 17 on the greater and lesser holy war, you find that in the traditional view, every reality was a symbol and every action was a ritual. As offensive as this might be to modern sensibilities, this even included war. For example, the concept of a heroic death was that the warrior would shift from the earthly material plane to the plane of a transcendental and universal struggle. If war were disconnected from its heroic or spiritual character, however, this would merely unleash animalistic impulses. In the Gita, for example, in Hinduism, there is talk of the inner attitude which is necessary to transform the lesser war into the greater holy war. It's no coincidence, then, that Indra and Odin were both gods of order and gods of battle, for war could be understood as the struggle for order to reign over chaos. The real unity of a people could only ever be sustained by sharing the same traditional spirit. This alone would withstand differences of opinion and other social conflicts. Of course, modern war has devolved from the holy war down to the status in which we have a groundless soldier thrown amidst mechanized technologies of destruction. This technological rationalization has actually made war no longer a conflict of man against man, but rather of machines against man. Therefore, you look at the games and victory in chapter 18, you see that in the world of tradition, far from being mere spectacles of entertainment, games were taken so seriously that it was considered dangerous to neglect performing them. It was also strictly prohibited, in fact, regarding who attended them. Women, as controversial as it is today, were not allowed to. The action itself had to take place, therefore, in the presence of symbols with higher meaning. The game symbolized something of a struggle to defeat death and overcome Hades. Above all, the athlete gives us the image of a victory over the body. Games, therefore, were the primary means to celebrate victories. In the world of tradition, a military victory had to be won on the mystical level before it could be won on any other, since it was understood that victory occurred precisely through having the local god abandon that site. Of course, under modern secularized materialism, war is just might makes right. In this context, man has devolved to the status of an animal, and ideas have shifted from magical symbols to mere abstractions and social conventions. That's even what many psychologists will tell you, that ideas are nothing more than that. It's no coincidence then that drugs are on the rise as a way to short-circuit the path to elude one's own sense of emptiness. The chapter 19 on space, time, and Earth will have to be broken up into three slides, if we consider one topic at a time. The first one will look at time. He notes that Kant's main error in his understanding of time was precisely the error of seeing the subjective forms as eternal, unchanging, and transcendentally purified. Even though Kant thought that was the big accomplishment, was to unearth these purified structures, Evola notes that notions as basic as time and space were understood very differently in the world of tradition. Today, time is basically understood to be an irrelevant succession of events. In the world of tradition, time was non-linear and it was inherently historical. Traditional time was qualitative rather than just quantitative. It was a rhythm rather than a mere series. There were cycles, great and small, and periods rather than the uniform and indefinite flow that we know today. On a qualitative level, times were understood to be favorable and unfavorable, depending on the time considered. This fit in with the logic of the traditional rite, because the time of performance was not indifferent. The rite had to be done at the right time. The right time was in turn determined by the two rhythms, the human and the natural. By the law of symmetry, the two would become one thing, and this would cause the invisible powers to act. Empirical time is measured by transcendent time, which does not really contain events, but rather contains meanings. The latter is the context in which myths, heroes, and gods lived and acted. This is something you find a remnant of in the understanding that some of the great heroes never died. This is even within the Bible. Therefore, in his analysis of space, you find that space today is basically just an indifferent container of bodies and motions. Kant actually calls the world a regulative idea. It's a matter of synthetic activity rather than like a real thing. That's how far this emptiness has been carried out, even in the 18th century. But in the traditional view, space is alive and saturated with qualities and with intensities. Each region has its own virtues and participates in the powers which reside there. Therefore, you have these two orders. You have magical and symbolic. You have earthly and heavenly, high and low, vertical, horizontal, left, right. You have these oppositions in the traditional view of space. And in turn, directions were not neutral. Every direction corresponded to certain influences or spirits. Nature, therefore, had to be understood as a symbol of transcendent realities. The experience of nature was, on one hand, not the secularized naturalistic stuff of modern science, but it also was not the romantic experience of the sublime. It was real sensations of supernatural powers that were understood to permeate places. The borders, therefore, between the eye and the not-eye were fluid, and in some cases they were partially removed in the world tradition. Man, however, who mocks spiritual dangers today, will find that he's not exactly free from them, even though he denies their existence. For you'll find that the complexes of collective unconscious, the emotive and irrational currents, and collective influences are far more harmful under precisely such a stance. We'll finish this discussion of chapter 19 with the earth. The ancient meaning of earth is also quite different. It meant a man and his land, blood and soil, as a living and intimate relationship. A given area was understood to really have a psychic individuality. Ownership of the land was therefore a sacred aristocratic privilege. Taking over the land was not merely a commercial transaction. It was linked to the spiritual principle of bringing order to chaos. Land ownership, needless to say, has completely lost the spiritual component and has devolved to something which can only be understood on political grounds. Although people usually celebrate this as a sign of liberation and progress, the result has actually been even more devastating for the land itself. Reduced to an instrument for generating economic value alone, it has only been ruthlessly exploited by machines. The sociological correlate of this reduction has also been a trend towards collectivism, first in the form of nationalism, then as socialism, then finally as communism. So far from rebelling against the destruction of the earth, communism is just the natural political outcome of following exactly that path. Therefore, one of the most controversial sections of the book will be in chapter 20, Man and Woman. This deals with the topic of gender. In the traditional view, the supernatural was seen as masculine and the natural was seen as feminine. Even if you have maybe a secularized view towards it, as Jordan Peterson does in Maps of Meaning, he notices if you actually examine ancient mythology, that's what you'll find. Against the modern theory that gender is merely performative, the traditional view held that the gender one was born into was the one which they had to realize. There was no question of mixing up different vocations in that context. But how did women actually actualize her role as woman? This, Evola claims, was through total love. Either total love for the son, which you have in the mother figure, or total love for the lover. These were the two types of the Demetrian and the Aphrodisiac woman. Controversial as this might be today, this means that in this worldview, woman's participation in the sacred hierarchical order was intrinsically mediated. It was realized in her relationship to the man, either as lover or son. Of course, this goes both ways. Evola notes that the crisis of the degradation of masculinity is something you find even among the surviving aristocrats, who could hardly imagine holding a sword, although that was precisely the aristocrats' role in the past. Feminism, in addition, is just another version, he claims, of formlessness of modernity. Feminism doesn't actually liberate women from the mediating relation to really realize themselves independently. It may basically just leaves them to imitate what had been observed before in masculinity, he argues. In addition, far from challenging the system, the sexual revolution was just the ultimate form of consumerism. Therefore, you find in chapter 21, that he addresses the crisis of overpopulation by designating it as just one more example of how chaos has overtaken form in the reduction of humans to purely quantitative category of concern. The solution, however, cannot just be to rationally engineer the population growth in a controlled fashion, which should be oriented towards yielding the best results. If we were to reduce human reproduction to just another example of like breeding horses, you might at the very best just get beautiful animals destined for work, kind of the domesticated animals which Kaczynski noted in the manifesto. This degradation is evident also in the way that to the extent that spirituality does survive today, it's reduced to religion. But mere religion is just another sign, he claims, of caste mixing and decadence. The higher forms of tradition are similarly preserved, but only as sacrilegious or even demonic entities. This is why David Icke, for example, routinely defends himself against the widespread myth that anybody who dabbles in channeling is doing devil worship. The way that the practices of tradition have come to be seen as literally literally devil worship is something which Evola also finds to be merely a sign of decadence.